This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 129 was recorded on August 2nd, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Jesse Felder, retired hedge fund manager and editor of the Felder Report, will join us as this week's feature interview guest. We'll take an extensive look at equity markets and discuss why Jesse is convinced that we're in a topping pattern. We're also going to have some important announcements after the market wrap before the interview with Jesse Felder. We'll tell you about our special programming plans to bring back Eurodollar University Season 2 in August, as well as an announcement about our Macro Voices live event in Toronto next week. Be sure to stay tuned for the post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll have extended equity market coverage, and when Patrick and I will discuss what each of us have planned for our presentations at Macro Voices Live next Friday in Toronto.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk about this S&P 500. What a throwback we had in just the last week. It certainly was felt pretty intense, particularly because so much of the selling came from the most popular stocks out there, particularly those FANG stocks that we'll probably end up hearing Jesse talk about throughout this interview. Nonetheless, markets are up a little bit today. We're right now trading at the 28-26 level on the S&P at the time of recording. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, I got to hand it to you, buddy. When we did this last week, you know, everybody was all excited about the big breakout, and you were saying, roll up the hedges, take profits, you know, at least short term, the risk reward is not favoring a wait here. And sure enough, we got that pullback. As far as what comes next, though, I got to tell you, Patrick, I have absolutely no clue what the next move is. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have a view. I have no idea in the short term whether we go up, down, or sideways from here. What I do have a strong view on is what to watch, and that's, is this going to complete a pattern which is a lower high or a double top or a new all-time high? That's the big picture signal. From a seasonality standpoint, it kind of seems like it's not quite time yet. Normally, August should play out, and by September, you start to see where the direction of the market is really headed next. So I don't think that that was probably it, you know, for the upside, if I had to guess here, but I'm guessing, and, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see if we get to new all-time highs or not. For now, I'm watching on the sidelines, and what I'm really looking for is, do we put in a lower high, do we put in a double top, or do we move to all-time highs? I don't think that there's going to be really any clear sense of direction for maybe another month or so. I know you've got a lot to say about the subject, Patrick. Let's save it for postgame, because I know you've got a chart book that our listeners are really going to be interested in.
All right. Well, let's move on then to the U.S. dollar index, and we'll touch on the S&P in the postgame. That U.S. dollar is really actually interesting, Mir, because obviously we've now gone through a couple weeks of consolidation after the last attempt to break legitimately above the 95 level and hold it. And here we are again, huge upsurge. We're north of 95 on the dollar index. Will it stick this time? Is this where we're going to get the big breakout?
Well, you know, I kept thinking that more and more times before, and it's been since June 14th that we first broke decisively above 94 into that 94-95 consolidation range. It's been 3.5 months. As the old saying goes, the longer you base, the higher in space. So if this is the beginning of that breakout, after 3.5 months of consolidation, I think we're looking at a really solid move higher. Probably, if you look at measured moves, at least high 90s, if not above 100 on the dollar index. Of course, the other side would be if this is a false move and we end up breaking down decisively below 94. Well, that's another story. I don't think that's likely. I think that maybe this is that breakout, but frankly, I've thought that several times before. What we really need here is daily closes that are above 95 or below 94. Well, we got above 95, at least so far today, and that's definitely a signal that something's afoot. Now, as far as a signal that we're actually seeing the breakout, I think we need daily closes above 95.5 or below 93.5. We may be getting close to the 95.5 level, but I'd like to see several daily closes above that level to really confirm to me that the move is on to the upside. side. If it is on, I think we're looking at high 90s, if not over 100 on the dollar index. And from a fundamental standpoint, if I look at that possibility that it could go either up or down, I definitely have a bullish bias, but I have to put an asterisk on the word fundamental. I'm really thinking more in terms of dollar short squeeze, the Jeff Snyder argument, as opposed to thinking that, you know, the dollar is getting stronger because the economy is just wonderful. I don't think it's really about that, but we'll see, wait and see what happens.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. And before we get to the price action itself, let's start with the inventory. How did things come in this week?
Well, you know, the thing I want to comment on first is what a roller coaster it's been for the last several weeks. Big build, big draw, big build, big draw. At some point, you got to take a step back and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe it's just dirty data and we're not getting clear information and people are perhaps overreacting to it a little bit. But in any case, the roller coaster ride continues. This week, it was a big build. Started on Tuesday afternoon with API reporting a massive, massive 5.6 million barrel build on inventory. Again, that's the API private number, not the official number. The official number came out on Wednesday morning at 3.8 million. Still a huge build on inventory, but not nearly as big as API had thought. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.3 million barrels. So still seeing a pattern of drawdowns in Cushing, even in the face of a very large national build. Gasoline drawing down 2.5 million barrels. Distillates building 3 million barrels. So it's pretty much a wash, you know, a little bit bigger build on distillates than there is a draw on gasoline. But the drawdowns continue in Cushing, Oklahoma. And I think that that Cushing number is actually what has my attention more than the headline number, the national number. Now, production was down 100,000 barrels this week, which has gotten a lot of attention in the press. Frankly, I think people are not quite caught up yet to the change that occurred in June in the reporting of the data. They round to the nearest 100,000 barrels. So, for example, if you hypothetically had a production level of 10.849 million barrels per day, and it rose over the course of a week by just 2,000 barrels to 10.851, the EIA would report that it had changed from 10.8 to 10.9 million barrels, and the press would respond by saying, production spikes 100,000 barrels in just 1 week. Well, they changed the way they report the data. It didn't spike. It was basically flat. It moved by 2,000 barrels, but it looks like a 100,000 barrel move because of the way that they've changed the data reporting starting in June. I don't think that the press has really gotten caught up with this yet, so they're not used to this new system of reporting. The reality of the situation is we moved one tick down, and it doesn't really mean anything. As far as the rest of the price action and reaction to inventory, we sold off more into Wednesday afternoon and Thursday, but then saw a big rally later in the day on Thursday. The drawdowns in Cushing, Oklahoma concern me more than the headline number because they represent a pretty strong and consistent trend of drawdowns, and we're at a very low level of storage in Cushing. And that, of course, reflects to this situation we've been tracking with the time spreads.
All right. Well, exactly that. For the last month, we've been talking about those time spreads and we've been following it closely. Has anything moved on that in the last few weeks?
Well, what's really interesting is what has not moved. We're still looking at the September-October spread out of range at $1.30 as we're speaking today. But, you know, and it normally would be much lower. The thing is, it's that one is going to expire in a few more weeks, and what we're not seeing is any big blowout in the October to November or November to December or December to January spreads. So it seems like the market thinks that there is a big physical shortage in Cushing, Oklahoma that, you know, is a really big deal right now, but is over next month. That's what the price data is telling us. The theory, of course, behind this is anybody who has oil that is in storage in Cushing, Oklahoma, that's not busy doing something else, they can arbitrage that spread. They can sell their oil for immediate delivery into the September contract, buy it back in the October contract by renting out their oil for just 1 month. They make $1.30. And if you look at the next month, the market is only paying, in order to rent that oil out, about 40 cents. So why is it that there's this very sudden change? It's as if everybody thinks a valve valve is going to get turned back on. I don't think it's just about Syncrude. It's much bigger than that, but it still is a mystery as to exactly what has caused this. I don't think the descriptions that the press has offered really explain the extent of the price action that we've seen.
All right, well, let's talk about the oil price itself then, because we were down at the 67 handle just earlier on the day, and then we just got a quick burst higher, almost back up to 69 on the upside at the time of recording. Oil seems very top-heavy, but we're getting these quick little reversals like this. What's your thinking in terms of what's next here for the price of oil?
Well, I have very low directional conviction right now. A lot of things could change quickly. The news flow has a lot to do with this. As you said yourself, you know, we got to watch the trend, and it seemed like for the last week we've been in a pretty consistent move down. It seemed like we put in a lower high, and we were maybe moving in the direction toward a lower low. And in order to get that lower low, we'd have to see the price move below $66. We got as low as 67 this morning. So, you know, we were within a dollar of being to a new lower low, which would really confirm a downtrend. And then today, the market reversed dramatically, and we've seen more than $2 of upside over the course of the day. So, you know, it's a wait and see. I don't think it's really clear yet, and I think the market is waiting for more signals to come from the geopolitical front and so forth. So I don't have very strong directional conviction here. Let's wait and see what happens.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because we had Brent Johnson on the show last week. And on a short-term basis, he was clearly pointing out the very oversold state of gold. And in principle, I completely agree with it. We're oversold. Gold has every reason to turn around and bounce and retrace this this big sell-off that we saw. But here we are with the dollar index looking like it wants to rip. I mean, does gold still have another leg lower, man? Let's just see where gold is likely to go here. What's your thinking on gold?
Well, first of all, I think it is all about the dollar index, as you alluded. But you said it's oversold. Market crashes don't start from overbought conditions. They start from oversold conditions. And I'm not necessarily predicting a crash, but the ingredients are there, Patrick. If you look at what's going on with the dollar, we have been basing for a long time between 94 and 95. I think that a decisive breakout above 95 could potentially spell a very quick move to 98, and before too much longer after that, continue on above 100. If that happens, it's a setup for a dump in gold. Now, believe me, I think gold is going to have its day, and when it does, it's going to be a fantastic buying opportunity, because I'm convinced 5 years from now, gold will have probably, I don't know, perhaps doubled in price. But I don't think that we're there yet. I don't think the bottom is in yet, and it's entirely about the dollar index. If the dollar fakes us out and ends up rolling over and moving back below 90, then it's a totally different game, and we miss the chance to buy gold, perhaps. I don't think it's going that way. I think we're going to higher dollar and lower gold.
You know, one interesting observation I'll make is that the gold seems to be far more mimicking the movement of the renminbi than it is actually the dollar index. And while I completely agree with you, you know, the drop in that renminbi has been quite significant. I mean, we're slowly approaching that 685, 690 overhead resistance on the currency there. It'd be very curious to see whether gold gets a bigger influence from the dollar index or whether it actually is going to stick to the most recent trend of pinning itself almost to the Chinese yuan here. Nonetheless, we'll watch it over the next little bit. Let's move on to that 10-year treasury yield, because here we are messing around with the 3% yield. You know, once again, the yields look like they want to break out. Is it going to happen? Or is this, I mean, I know you were talking the 305, 310 level. What's your feeling? Is this still a range?
Yeah, I think there's two ranges. The big wide range is 260 to 310. The narrower range is 280 to 3%. And we spent a couple of weeks hovering around right at the bottom of that narrower range, right around 280, just above it. Now we're hanging around at the top of that range, 298, as I look at the chart right now. And that's just a couple of basis points below that 3% round number resistance. So, you know, we're at the other end of the range. I don't really feel a strong directional conviction here. I'd say if you started to see a 305, potentially that's an entry point for a short just because the risk reward is pretty strong. You figure you need a stop around 312 or so, which would be a new intraday high in yield since what we saw previously. And that's 7 basis points away from a 305 entry, which ought to be the next significant resistance point. And I think you could target to the downside about 283 or so. So that's 22 basis points of downside against 7 basis points of risk for your stop. You know, not bad. But I don't really have a really strong directional conviction. I think eventually we probably do break out to the upside to higher rates. I just won't be surprised if we catch everybody off guard and have a move back down toward 260 before that happens.
All right. Well, before we get on to our feature interview, we have some announcement to make. Eric, why don't you fill our listeners in? What's our plan for the summer?
Well, we're going to air Eurodollar University Season 2 starting next week. So for the next 3 Thursdays, first of all, we're going to have an early release schedule at noon Eastern time on the 9th, 16th, and 23rd of August. And those shows will be pre-recorded. There's no market wrap or post-game. It's 100% Jeff Snyder, Eurodollar University Season 2. It's in 3 parts, and they're really fantastic. If you haven't yet, if for any new listeners that are joining us, if you didn't already listen to Eurodollar University when we first aired it, it's still available free of charge at macrovoices.com/EDU. Use your time between now and next week to listen to all 4 parts of Eurodollar University Season 1, because what we're really airing is parts 5, 6, and 7, the logical continuation of a series that began last year. So if you haven't already, familiarize yourself with that. Starting next week on August 9th, it'll be Eurodollar University Part 5, then Part 6 on the 16th, and Part 7 on the 23rd. We'll be back on August 30th with our regular format.
All right. Well, speaking of Macro Voices Live, our first live event is being held in Toronto next Friday. And we have a couple announcements to make there as well. Why don't you share with our listeners the update?
Well, first of all, folks, I'm sorry, but sold out really does mean sold out. We've been getting lots of inquiries begging to find a way to squeeze one more person in. Every single seat is full. It's 100% sold out. Please don't be angry with us. We did warn you when we first announced this event that we expected a sellout because we designed it as a very cozy event where everybody's going to get an opportunity to meet the speakers and spend time talking to one another. We have gotten so much overwhelming demand. I don't know if demand's even the right word. Maybe threats would be more accurate. Saying, guys, I didn't get in. I wanted to go so badly. You gotta do videos. You gotta. What we said to you once before several weeks ago is we promised to get some kind of recording, at least audio, maybe video. We've gone ahead and finalized our decision to hire a professional video crew to come and make the entire event available to people who were not able to get in because either they didn't register in time or they live too far away or whatever the issue may be. So the deal is anyone who donates a minimum of $50 to Macro Voices in 2018 will get full access to the videos. Now, don't be afraid to donate more than $50. Quite frankly, we think this is worth a lot more than $50. It would certainly cost that if it were normally priced. We had agreed to produce this event just making sure that we break even. And if you want to know where the $50 price came from, it was 100 people times $50 allows us to break even on the $5,000 it's costing us to hire the professional video crew to come in and shoot this. That doesn't give us funding for the next exciting project, and you, our audience, have the power to inspire us to do really cool stuff in the future. So keep those donations coming and be generous. We really appreciate it, and it very much changes what we're able to do for you. We have received a couple of dozen $50 donations since we first announced this a few weeks ago, and quite a few $100, $200, $250, and even one $500 donation that have been received since we announced this. So we tremendously appreciate that support, and it directly influences our ability to plan the next event and bring you more exciting content. We'll have an update for you on our August 30th show with respect to when you can expect those videos to be produced and released. We've gotten some requests from people who want to come to the after party. This has been announced already to people attending the event. We're doing a dinner with the speakers. They've asked whether it's okay to bring a spouse or a guest who is not registered to attend the event. Yes, we're going to let you do that, but each person does have to have a ticket. So contact Christiane can at Big Picture Trading if you need to buy any additional tickets for guests or spouses that you want to bring with you to the dinner event. And we look forward to seeing you folks next week in Toronto.
All right. So this week's featured interview guest is Jesse Felder from the Felder Report. Eric's interview with Jesse is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Jesse Felder, editor and publisher of The Felder Report, one of the most popular newsletters, as well as also the occasional Felder Report podcast, which is also extremely popular with listeners. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us. I've got a lot I want to cover. First of all, listeners, Jesse put a great slide deck together for us. The download link is in your research roundup email. We're going to start with that. Then there's also a blog post to discuss, also linked in your research roundup email. Jesse, let's start with this chart deck. As I go to chart number two here, I notice you're talking about some popular concepts, dot-com bubble, housing bubble, and then everything bubble. I love the metaphor. It feels good. But I want you to be real specific with me. What are you talking about everything bubble? Exactly what do you mean? Because dot-com bubble and housing bubble, everybody knew exactly what that meant. Why is it an everything bubble, and what is causing there to be a price inflation bubble in so many different asset classes all at once?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, this chart basically just tracks household net worth relative to disposable income. And it's a chart that the Fed has been putting out for years and tracking. And I think to me, this is just the most obvious representation of what's going on in financial assets right now. And so what is the everything bubble? It's essentially net worth is comprised of stocks, bonds, and real estate, primarily, you know, household net worth. So, you know, I think it's not just one of those things. So we've seen housing bubble in 2005, 6, 7, and today it's not just one of those things. You know, its valuations are at least as high as they were back in the dot-com mania. By a lot of measures, they're even more of a value than they were, back then. But housing prices have also come back, and you look at like housing prices to household income, and we're back about as high as we were during the housing bubble in terms of housing prices, housing valuations. And then there's also, you know, what's going on in the bond market with interest rates so low, bond prices have gotten extremely high also. So it's a combination of all of those. So I think it just makes most sense to refer to it as the everything bubble because it's not just one asset class. It's all asset classes are priced very high today.
So what is driving this everything bubble? Is it accommodative central bank policy or is it something else?
No, absolutely. And the central banks have been totally candid about this. They said, we wanted to create a wealth effect, so we're going to buy up risk-free assets and push people, you know, out on the risk curve to try and create a wealth effect. And so they have accomplished that. The side of it that they haven't accomplished, or I guess is probably arguable, is if rise in financial assets has actually created a self-sustaining economic recovery. And so I think that's kind of the big question now is to see, okay, now when we're unwinding the stimulus, is the economy going to be able to do what it's done, continue without suffering the reverse of that effect?
So the academics would probably like us to believe that they have jump-started the vehicle. It is running on its own, and it's able to continue without stimulus. The counter-argument is you take away the punch bowl, and the party's over. What do you think? Is the everything bubble going to pop as we move from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening?
I think it stands to reason that if, you know, to the extent the markets have been supported by extreme central bank intervention, to the extent that that's removed, you see the equal and opposite effect. So I do think that is a huge risk right now. And I think it's especially important to notice that these policies are not being unwound because they want to unwind them. I think we're starting to see inflationary pressures really take off and really force the hand of the Fed and eventually the ECB and the Bank of Japan. Because you know that's what's really gone on over the last couple of years. Yeah, the Fed has been unwinding policy, but you still have 0% interest rates in Europe and Japan. And so we've had European and Japanese investors coming into especially our bond market and our corporate bond markets, keeping spreads low and providing that supportive backdrop for the equity markets. So, you know, to me, I'm more watching the ECB and the Bank of Japan because, you know, to the extent they're forced to normalize policy, we could see investor flows move back home to those countries if, you know, they start to see some positive nominal interest rates over there.
You and I have agreed for the last few years that probably on a reasonable fundamental evaluation level, assets are overvalued. But of course, there have been so many factors that has caused them to continue to get even more overvalued. Is it finally coming to an end? Are we in a topping process? And I couldn't help but really be intrigued by that Jeremy Grantham quote, which David Rosenberg shared with us a few weeks ago in his chart book, just saying, you know, it's at the point where the smart people ought to be able to see it's time for the bull market to be over. And that's exactly the time when sometimes markets like to fool you. And there's one more just insanity-driven push higher. Do you think it's finally over, which is what David Rosenberg thought? Or do you think there's a risk that maybe there really is one last hurrah in the bull market before things finally start to move in the other direction?
I really believe that what we've seen since early 2016 low over the last 2 years, really that early 2016 to February of this year, was the final blow off. I do think we probably technically had a recession and a bear market in 15 and early 16. You look at like gross value added of, you know, U.S. corporations fell for three consecutive quarters in real terms. I mean, that's in any other time in the last 67 years, that was enough to qualify as a recession. I mean, the stock markets got hammered in August of 15 and then again in early 16 as a result of that. Then we saw this kind of a global stimulus, not only the ECB and Bank of Japan being exceptionally easy, but, you know, the Chinese authorities came in and created stimulus that created this last 2 years of an extension of the bull market. But I think, you know, throughout the rest of these charts in my chart book, I think there's a lot of evidence that points to we're right in the midst of a major topping process right now. And I'll just skip to some of these other charts, but this is chart 6, and that's just the nominal level of margin debt. And a lot of people like to say, well, margin debt doesn't matter, but there was a great quote in The Great Crash, 1929, written by John Kenneth Galbraith, and he discussed this. He said, even the most circumspect friend of the market would concede that the volume of broker's loans, of loans collateral by the securities purchased on margin, is a good index of the volume of speculation. And one of the signs that speculation was out of hand in the late 20s was these broker loans were off the chart. Well, that's what we're seeing again today. And margin debt is just soared to astronomical levels. It's more than twice as big as it was at the peak of the dot-com mania. Even when you normalize it to GDP or something else, it's way bigger than it was at the last two major market peaks.
Hang on just a second there, Jesse, because you know, you say normalize it to GDP. It seems to me like what's really relevant is not so much the absolute nominal dollar amount, but what is it as a percentage of market capitalization? When you look at it in that terms, we've seen asset prices move so much that in terms of a percentage of market capitalization, is it really at all-time extremes now, or is it actually more in line?
Well, that's where I come back to chart number 9 here from top-down charts. And so I don't think margin debt in itself, because that has been pretty much flat over the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years as a percentage of market cap. But margin debt is not the only way to express leverage in the markets. When you add in net leveraged ETFs, which we've never seen how these things perform in a major bear market, they just were not used in the size that they are currently. And then you add net speculative futures positioning. When you add total stock market leverage via those three vehicles, as a percentage of market cap, it's bigger than ever before in history. So, you know, people want to say margin debt by itself is, you know, normalize it to market cap. That's not a problem. It's been flat for the last 10 years or so. It really hasn't gotten massively extreme. But then when you see the extra leverage poured on by leveraged ETFs, and in the futures markets, total net leverage right now in the markets is just completely off the charts. It's 5 times bigger than what it was as a percentage of market cap than it was back in the dot-com mania. And that's just data that comes from top-down charts, which is another great service that that I like to look at. But turning to these other indicators that I think, to me, point to this evidence of this topping process is, you know, you look at chart number 10 here. Here's another actually indicator people like to make fun of, and that's basically just the Hindenburg omen. And Hindenburg omens by themselves are not super valuable. You might have Hindenburg omen triggered in the market and on any given day, and that's basically just stocks within a new all-time high or a 12-month high. But you're having a lot of new rising new lows. You have a lot of new lows in the market in addition to new highs. So it basically just shows increasing dispersion in the market. And like I said, when you see like a single indication of a Hindenburg omen on the NYSE or the NASDAQ, it's not super valuable. But when you go back and you look and say, okay, how many Hindenburg omens across both indexes were triggered over the last 10 days, last 30 days, last 6 months, you can see how this dispersion becomes more prevalent over periods of time. And so I like to look at 6 month total is maybe pretty valuable. How many Hindenburg omens have been triggered over the last 6 months across both indexes? When you look over the last 20 years or so, you can see that the only time when the markets have triggered like 20 Hindenburg omens within a 6 month period was at the 2000 top and at the 2007 top. The beginning of this year, we saw that again back actually in November, December, January of, you know, right around the turn of the new year, we saw over 20 Hindenburg omens, 24, 25 Hindenburg omens triggered across both indexes. So that just tells me there's just huge dispersion going on under the surface. That's very indicative of a classic topping process. So you have the breadth warning, and then you also have, you look at, you know, I like to use DeMarc indicators that trigger basically exhaustion triggers. In November, December, we had a monthly DeMarc sell signal trigger on the S&P 500. And in the fourth quarter of last year, a quarterly sell signal trigger. So these are very, very long-term exhaustion signals that were triggered late last year. And they also come in the midst of a big-time cluster of Fibonacci targets between 2,700 and 2,800 on the S&P 500. To me, when you put those all together, it suggests a high probability of a major topping process right now. And then add in things like the Smart Money Index, which shows massive liquidation going on under the surface. Another classic indicator of a topping process.
Jesse, I have to apologize. This is it's so fascinating to talk to you. You sometimes distract me away from the order of your slide deck. So I jumped around a bit there. Let's go back to the Buffett yardstick on page 4 that I kind of skipped over. Why don't we talk through what that's about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that if you we want to look at just the stock market, which is really my area of expertise, if I have any at all, Warren Buffett back in the late 1999, actually, I think he said, you know, there's one indicator that is the single best measure of where stocks at any given point in time. He wrote an article for Fortune magazine describing this, and it's basically just the market cap of the total stock market compared to the economy, or GNP in this case. And in this version of this indicator, we're very close to where we were at the dot-com mania. I've seen other versions of this indicator that show stocks more overvalued today than they were in 2000. But the value in this, that was slide 3. Here's slide 4, is when you flip this upside down, the Buffett yardstick upside down, it has a very, very high correlation with future 10-year returns in the stock market. Pretty much tells you what stocks are going to do over the next 10 years, at least on average. And I think this is probably the best representation of the Buffett quote, the price you pay determines your rate of return. If you pay a high price, you get a low rate of return and vice versa. So you could see back in the early 80s when stocks were very, very cheap, if you had bought stocks in, you know, 81, 82, you had almost a 15% average annual rate of return going forward over the next decade. Currently, the measure suggests stocks are so expensive that we should expect a negative average annual rate of return over the next decade, even after dividends. So this suggests probably losing about 2% per year on average over the next 10, including dividends. So, you know, that's like a nominal minus 4% or something rate of return before dividends. So the long-term picture for stocks is just such that investors today, I like to call it reward-free risk. We're taking a ton of risk of another major drawdown. What is the potential reward for taking that risk? It's, you know, maybe zero at best.
Okay, so we have a setup here, which is things are at very, very high levels, all-time high levels. That's true of stocks, it's true of bonds, it's true of real estate, it's true of a lot of things. And it's a setup for lousy returns. We have to really wonder, though, if the top is in. And you have a blog post out recently that suggests maybe the FANG stocks, which have been a very good leading indicator on the way up, could be signaling what comes next for the stock market. So referring again for listeners in your Research Roundup email, you've got a link to Jesse's blog post where there are several more charts talking about how the FANG stocks may be a leading indicator of what's coming next. Walk us through the blog post. Tell us what the summary is of what your expectations are based on this information.
There's been actually a lot of deterioration in the stock market this year outside of the FANG stocks. You know, the FANG stocks and the NASDAQ recently hit a new high, but most of the other indexes peaked in, late January, early February. And you look at like the NYSE composite and the Dow, and they're not close to making new highs, even while the FANG stocks are. This is really, to me, reminiscent of the 2000 topping process. When the Dow hit a new high, its final high in December, I think, of 99, the NASDAQ peaked in March of 2000, and then the NYSE composite actually made a new high, I think, in the fall, maybe September of 2000. And they all kind of made separate peaks and then rolled over into late 2000, early 2001. And I think we could be seeing something like that again right now, where most indexes peaked in January, February, but the NASDAQ is making new highs right now, even while the NYSE composite remains well off its own. And it's really just been the FANG stocks that have been holding up the broader markets lately. But, you know, with Facebook and Netflix really getting hammered last week, and deservedly so. I mean, these stocks trade at their highest valuations in their short histories, even as their growth is really slowing down and profitability at Facebook is looking, you know, is deteriorating really rapidly, and Netflix has no profitability to speak of. So if investors are starting to think about these things in a different way and say, wait a second, what were we pricing into these stocks, right? If we're willing to pay the highest valuations in their history, that means there's a lot of assumptions embedded in there, like their growth is going to continue, that their profit margins will stay high, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, these are also the same assumptions that are embedded in the broader stock market. When you look at the S&P 500, the median price to sales ratio is completely off the charts. This is another valuation metric, 50% higher than it was at the peak of the dot-com mania. And you think about what the assumptions that are embedded in that. Well, it's that profit margins are going to stay high, growth is going to stay good, interest rates are going to stay low, et cetera, et cetera. That's what it means to be priced for perfection. And if perfection does not materialize, then you have to have a reckoning between expectations and reality. And I think that's what we're seeing with Facebook and Netflix currently. And I think those stocks in particular have plenty of room to the downside just from the valuation standpoint, if they continue to disappoint. And that's also true for the broad market too, that if growth and profitability does not live up to investor assumptions right now, there's going to be a similar reckoning for the broad market. And it probably means, you know, I mean, how do you get this long-term forecast that the Buffett indicator is saying, where you lose 2 or 3% a year over 10, well, you have to have probably some type of a bear market that brings valuations back to reality, some type of a historical average. If that's the case, it leaves plenty of downside for the markets. I do believe, I think, that this reckoning that's going on in the FANG stocks could be representative of a broader reckoning of valuation, like I was mentioning. And it really, to bring me back to 2000 again, you know, Intel, it was the fall of 2000 where Intel missed earnings. And you look at what were the greatest one-day drops in equity value in history? Well, Facebook just set the record last week when it lost $120 billion in a day. I think it was like number two or three on the list was Intel, and that was September of 2000 when Intel dramatically disappointed investors, and that marked a turning point for the dot-com mania. That was kind of like the final nail in the coffin where the NASDAQ peaked in March, Intel disappointed in September, and it was just, you know, off to the bear market from that point. I think there's a good chance that Facebook last week could be, you know, our version of Intel in the fall of 2000.
Jesse, let's assume for the sake of conversation that what's going on here is we are seeing a topping process and the everything bubble is reaching its conclusion and it's at a top now. Well, the problem I have with that is, as you've said, it's an everything bubble. It's not just stocks. It's not like, okay, if stocks are overvalued, it's time to go into bonds instead. The stocks are overvalued, the bonds are overvalued, the real estate's overvalued because of central bank easy money policy basically pushing the value of everything up. So I guess that leaves me, and it's a perfect question for an old school value investor like yourself. How the heck do you value invest if nothing is a value? What do you do here? It seems like it may be a good time to take profits and be out of the market or reduce your equity exposure. But what do you move to? Where's the defensive play?
That's a great question. I have also written another post recently where I do agree with you that there isn't much value at all to be found within the major indexes. And I think this is where value investors are making some big mistakes. I don't want to own relative value. I don't want to own stocks that are cheap relative to expensive stocks, but are cheap not in their own right. You know, I look at a lot of stocks. One of the ways that I value stocks, I want to look at its valuation history. And I want to own something when it's cheap relative to its own history. And that's really not the case for so many different stocks. You look at almost all the Dow stocks. There are very few of them that are cheap relative to their own history. Most of them, like McDonald's and Boeing and 3M, all trade at their highest valuations in their own company history. And so where I have found value over the last couple of years, especially, are in things that are outside the purview of the indexes. So I really do think that this is another speculative mania. This time, instead of being driven by, you know, a dot-com craze or anything like that, this is being driven by kind of a euphoria surrounding the idea of passive investing. And so anything that has to do with passive, including buying a value-based index in a passive fashion, is not going to be, you know, fall in what I would categorize as true value. So where I found value is outside of the indexes, and really, this hit home for me when I talked to Steve Bregman a little over a year ago, and he pointed out to me that owner-operated companies are systematically under-owned by the indexes because they don't have enough free float for the indexes to be able to allocate money to them. So they're systematically under-owned by the indexes. And really, these are the companies that you find do the best over time. And so I think where investors can find value is by owner-operated companies that have relatively low float and are ignored by the indexes. Those are the only places where I've found value. That said, I own a portfolio of those, and then it's fully hedged against general market risk because of these other things that I've mentioned before.
Seems to me like the things that are actually depressed in price right now, grains are certainly depressed. I'm not sure if they've got further to go to the downside. I look at something like gold. Well, it's not at the top of a bubble, but at the same time, I think there's a pretty good bullish case for the dollar to continue to show strength here. I think maybe gold's got more downside in it. What do you think about those things? Are gold mining stocks or agricultural stocks a defensive play here, given the valuations that they're suffering from?
I do think so. There's a couple of agricultural stocks that I own more from just a bottom-up perspective. I'm not much of a top-down type of investor, but from a macro perspective, I do think gold is absolutely critical to own right now. And I think this rally in the dollar we've seen over the last few months is an exceptionally generous gift from Mr. Market to people who want to own gold, because, you know, gold has gotten hurt over the last, you know, I mean, it's down 10% or something over the last few months. But when you look at the ratio, the value of gold or any kind of real assets versus financial assets, real assets, and I've been talking about this for a couple of years now, are just extremely cheap relative to financial assets. And, you know, part of that's because financial assets are so extremely expensive. Stocks and bonds are both so highly valued. But part of that is because, like you said, commodities have been severely depressed. I'm also bullish on gold for the simple fact that our deficits are just starting to blow out. And the deficit is widening faster than anybody has anticipated, and it's during an economic expansion. And so, you know, this is kind of an unprecedented experience, which is, historically speaking, you know, widening deficits is not good for the dollar, and it's actually very good for the gold price. And, you know, I think they're talking now about deficits on the scale of over $1 trillion next year, which is, I think, just a very bullish backdrop for the gold price, too.
Jesse, I want to go back now to your original slide deck. Ray Dalio has been writing for the last couple of years about how the current environment may be analogous in some ways to 1937. You've got a chart on page 13 of the chart book that talks to that. Please walk us through it.
Yeah, it was actually, I think, like early 2015, he first proposed this idea. So 3 years ago, he started drawing parallels to our current economic expansion and environment to that of 1937. And then he updated it again right after the presidential election in the context of growing populism. This is something that I've kind of kept in the back of my mind since he first wrote about it, because it is such an interesting kind of fundamental parallel. But what really kind of brought it back to the forefront of my mind recently was this price analog. That's slide 13 I put in the chart book, where there's like a 94% correlation between the last 3 years or 4 years in the stock market and those 4 years leading into the 1937 top. So very highly correlated price action now that I think kind of justifies or backs up this fundamental analog, which I'll just walk through it real quick. He basically draws this parallel by starting with the 1929 and 2007 kind of economic and stock market peaks, where debt limits reached a bubble peak, causing the economy and markets to peak. That's the first parallel. Number two, interest rates then hit zero amid depression. That would be 1932 and 2008. Number three, money printing starts kicking off a beautiful deleveraging, 1933, 2009. And, you know, in our case, the deleveraging is mainly in mortgage debt. I would say corporations have been leveraging up this cycle, but there's still that deleveraging on the mortgage side, which is parallel to the depression. Four, the stock market and risky assets rally. That would be 33 to 36 and 2009 to 2017. Then the economy improves during a cyclical recovery. Finally, the central bank tightens a bit, resulting in a self-reinforcing downturn. And this is what he has been warning about, is that to the extent that the economy has been boosted by this asset price reflation, the reversal of that could create, in Dalio's words, a self-reinforcing downturn. You know, more than ever before, the Fed has created an economy that is dependent upon consumers feeling good based on what asset prices are doing. So stock market goes up, they feel good, maybe they spend a little bit more, but that could potentially work in reverse, such that if, you know, QE reversal or quantitative tightening results in fallen asset prices, we're starting to see weakness in real estate globally, you know, London. And I think Bloomberg had a story out today profiling London and Toronto and Australia and essentially real estate weakness around the world. That's also kind of met with equity market weakness and, God forbid, some bond market weakness. You could see another self-reinforcing downturn. And I just thought it was curious also that there's now this technical kind of validation of the fundamental parallels in this 1937 analog.
And if I look at this chart, if that 94% correlation were to continue to hold true, it looks like it forecasts approximately a 30% bear market between now and the first quarter of 2019. Is that what you're expecting? And if so, what do you do about it? Do you hedge your portfolio for that? Do you just lighten up on your positions? How do you respond to this outlook?
Yeah, I think for the average investor, the thing to think about is, you know, what is my time frame, and matching their risk to their time frame. I think there's a lot of people who are taking on way more risk than they would otherwise be comfortable with, and usually they don't reconcile that until they've actually lost enough money to try and make a change. You know, think about, hey, you know, if we do have another bear market over the next few years, how would you want to be positioned through that? Is your time frame really 20 years, you know, like a lot of passive investors claim? Would you be really uncomfortable going through another 30, 40, 50% drawdown? And if that's the case, look at any asset allocator. You know, actually, Ray Dalio is a perfect example. Ray Dalio and his all-weather, all-seasons portfolio has no more than 15% allocated to the U.S. stock market, and this is his permanent portfolio. Under ideal circumstances, he would still only have 15% allocation or so to U.S. stocks. So, you know, diversification is extremely important. Ray Dalio and any other asset allocator, David Swensen, would, you know, back that up. I think today one of the mistakes probably investors are making is, I want to own 50, 60, 70, 80% of my portfolio in U.S. equities. And even the most aggressive asset allocators on the planet aren't that aggressive.
Jesse, I'd like to bring up a theory that I've had for many years and many of our Macro Voices listeners are familiar with, which is in a deflationary backdrop, you can get away with just about anything. The Fed can solve any problem by printing up some more money. But when you get to an inflationary backdrop, particularly secular inflation that runs the risk of becoming runaway inflation, suddenly the central bankers' hands are tied, because if they try to just conjure more money out of thin air, they exacerbate the inflation problem. Do you think I'm right, first of all, with that theory that's where the end game gets ugly, is when their hands are tied because of an inflationary backdrop? So number one, am I on the right track with that theory? But number two, we're starting to see those signs of inflation picking up. Are we getting to the point where that's going to be a risk?
I agree completely. A couple things to add to that. You know, in terms of the inflationary backdrop, I recently did a podcast with Eric Cinnamon, who's, you know, a good friend of mine, small cap fund manager, who's had just an exceptional performance over the last 20 plus years. And he listens to 300 conference calls every quarter. And for the last at least 3-4 quarters, he's been hearing companies talk about the greatest inflationary pressures in decades. And not just here in the United States, but globally. And so this is something that I've also been tracking. Inflation is here, and it's real. And the numbers are only starting to show. But even just look at something like the Fed's underlying inflation gauge. And that thing is running super hot right now. And it is a leading indicator of what CPI and the other things are doing. So inflation is here. Yes, that's a problem for the Fed. I talked to William White, who was the chief economist at the BIS. I talked to him about a year ago. And he said, really, in terms of this inflation dynamic, what we've witnessed over the last 30 years or something is essentially an environment of monetary policy dominance, where the Fed has been able to do what it wants to do because the fiscal authorities have kind of laid back and allowed them to do that. But now, for the first time in at least 35 years, we're seeing a fiscal authority here in the United States that is challenging the monetary authority's dominance. And so that potentially, when the fiscal authorities do what they did, we're talking about lowering taxes, we're talking about trade war, we're talking about things that create inflationary pressures. That forces the Fed to take a back seat. It forces the monetary authorities to take a back seat and say, okay, now we have to fight inflation because fiscal authority is taking over. And so I think this is something that most people don't appreciate well enough right now. And a lot of people say, as soon as the market goes down X percent, the Fed's going to ride to the rescue with more QE. Well, it's very, very possible that because of what the fiscal authority is doing right now in terms of these creating these or exacerbating these inflationary dynamics, that the Fed's hands will be tied even if the market does go down a certain X percentage because of these rising inflationary pressures exacerbated by the administration's policies.
And I think that's the moment right there. It's when the Fed announces, no, we're not going to ride into the rescue. We understand that the market's down 30%, but we're not able to come to the rescue. That's not the business that we're in. That's when things really get ugly, and I fear that we're headed there. Do you agree with that outlook? And if not, why not?
Well, yeah, I mean, you think about the whole buy the dip mentality, you know, has been inspired over the last 10 years by the Fed put. And what you're talking about is essentially the expiration of the Fed put, you know. And so if there is no Fed put, this buy the dip mentality is gone, and the markets will be left to actually real price discovery again. That would have to be frightening to most investors, I would think.
Jesse, before we close, I want to move on to the Felder Report. Talk to us a little bit about what people can expect there and how they can sign up for a free subscription.
Yeah, and the FelderReport.com, just right there on the homepage, is a sign up for, I think, my email newsletter. Goes out every Saturday. I do a ton of reading every day, so I've spent the first 3-4 hours of my day just reading a bunch of research, charts, news, looking for changes in the broad consensus, changes in trends. And I put together probably every weekend 5 things that I think are most relevant from the past week, send that out in a free email on Saturday mornings. That's free to sign up for at thefelderreport.com.
And you also have a fantastic podcast that is produced on a semi-regular schedule. Tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, for me, it's a way to scratch my own itch. There's a number of people like you, Eric. We had a wonderful conversation on the podcast. Enjoyed that one. That I just really am eager to talk to and pick their brain about, you know, what it is that drives their investment process and really what their evolution as an investor has looked like and how they got to where they are. And so when I come across somebody or a topic or something that really piques my interest, I usually approach them and record a conversation. It's just usually an hour, hour and a half of something of us just exploring a topic. And it's not a regular thing. It's totally irregular because I'm lazy, but also it's really when it piques my curiosity. So that's Super Investors in the Art of Worldly Wisdom is the name of the podcast.
And that's also available free of charge at thefelderreport.com. Jesse, thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jesse back onto the show. We've had so many guests come on, but they were very big picture, and we talked about just about everything but the stock market in detail. So it's nice to have a guest come on with a focus on what's happening in the equity markets. And no shortage of bearish perspective, I would take, having had David Rosenberg on the show and then followed up now with Jesse. We're certainly getting a number of these people coming on that are generally viewing this as a topping formation, which it generally is also my view. But you know what? It's always going to be interesting to see how these things play out. The market certainly has the potential still to surprise everyone. You know, there could certainly still be one more leg to this and delay this entire bearishness. But, you know, I want to talk about that in a little bit. But what did you take away from the interview?
Well, the thing that struck me the most was Jesse's chart showing total S&P leverage, because this is something that I've pushed back on a lot of people on is, you know, they'll say, hey, look at the margin interest. It's at all-time records. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, look at the level of the S&P. It's at all-time records too. You've got to look at it on a relative basis. Jesse's chart showing the net leverage, including the ETFs and futures and so forth, moving to an all-time record. That was a legit chart. That was information was presented in the right way, and it really makes a compelling argument that there is potential for a really ugly unwind. And that's something I had been questioning, as some of the guests that we've had on the program have told us, you know, people are expecting a crash. You generally don't get a crash unless there is excessive leverage in use and excessive retail participation with just senseless euphoria. You can't really have the crash unless there's that retail participation to panic and the leverage to get unwound that really creates that perfect storm event that results in a market crash. And what I'm seeing is, at least from the leverage perspective, that component really is there. And I had been dismissing the argument about margin interest until I saw that chart today. So I thought that was particularly interesting. I still think, though, that we don't have the kind of retail participation euphoria that is necessary to fuel something like a 2008-sized crash. Patrick, let's go ahead and move on. You know, I'm looking forward to comparing notes with you on what we're each speaking about at Macro Voices Live next week in Toronto, and I'm certainly looking forward to meeting a number of our listeners there. Before we get to that, though, let's dive into this chart book that you prepared. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Postgame Chart Book, and starting on page 2, you've got a line that shows like maybe we're at a pretty critical level on the U.S. dollar index. Tell us what's going on here.
Absolutely. Well, first off, we just want to kind of emphasize that we're not going to be doing these market wraps during the next 3 weeks while we're on vacation and we're running the Euro Dollar University. So I thought it was really important that we just take a step back and look at some of the bigger picture charts on this and sort of leave our listeners with some notes as to what they should be looking for throughout the month of August till we're back on the air live again, giving everyone updates at the end of August. So really what I wanted to do is really really talk about what I think are the three big charts to really watch. The first one, obviously, like you're talking about here on this U.S. dollar index. And what's interesting here is that the U.S. dollar index on the weekly charts, when you look at the consolidation that we've been going through for the last 3 months, it's almost negligible in terms of the chart. Like, it really doesn't look like a throwback at all. And with the U.S. dollar index kind of slowly edging to the top in that range, this is truly a place where it's a make it or break it breakout zone. I don't want to already be counting this as an official breakout and it's started, but boy, is this going to be, in my mind, a very big, important thing for August. If during the next couple of weeks we have this breakout above the 95 handle, there's a number of measured moves and Fibonacci zones that lie in the 97 and 98 area, but then there's that round number near 100 that is going to be rather sticky and maybe push the dollar index up into that zone. I don't want to officially say it's going there, but boy, I think in the macro markets, if this move started and really got momentum over the next month, I think it would be incredibly important for all the other markets. I think that things get a little bit scarier if that kind of risk-off scenario of finding safe haven in the dollar really starts to gain momentum. What's your thinking?
Well, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we are both, let's just make sure that we are honest with everyone, we're both kind of jumping the gun here because we have not seen a decisive signal that the breakout is on. I think both of us kind of have a gut feeling that that might be what comes next. And of course, markets love to embarrass as many people as possible. So for all we know, it makes an abrupt U-turn and goes straight down for the next 3 weeks. And we look silly when we get back on August 30th. I think the more likely case and the more important point is, if you see the break above this red line that you've got shown here right at 95 or just above 95, if you see that break and it is confirmed, you know, boy, I just think 98 is probably a resistance level. You maybe get a 50% retrace and then you go up and you break through 98 and you get close to 100 well before the year is out. I think there's plenty of room to see that happen. And my fundamental leaning, as I said in the market wrap, is not based on, oh, it's a wonderful economy and you know, the U.S. is in such great shape and that's the reason that we're going to see a stronger dollar. It's much more of a dollar squeeze scenario, as Jeff Snyder has described. And I think it potentially could really get going here. And then the next big question after that is going to be, okay, you know, we've got to get first to 100, then to the prior highs. Do we actually move to the point where this was a mid-cycle correction from, what was it, 104 all the way down to 89, and now we're going to move to 110 or something? Now, it's way premature to say something like that, but I'm starting to think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, because I'll tell you can get to 95, you can get to 98 without causing a whole lot of problems around the world. You don't go to 110 without causing major, major problems around the world, particularly in emerging markets. And, you know, there's no reason to think we're going there yet, but I definitely think that over coming months, the dollar index is probably the most important signal to watch.
Eric, I couldn't agree more, you know, and I love that one saying. I wish I remembered who said it. I'm paraphrasing, but it really is, forecast me the direction of the dollar and I can tell you the performance of every other asset class. It's such an important thing to see what happens here next in that dollar. But I want to move on to the second chart on page 3. And here I have the 10-year treasury yields on the U.S. government bonds. And this is such an interesting chart because obviously we've had a number of prominent guests, including Jeff Sherman from Double Line, and obviously many viewing this idea that there's still a legitimate risk that yields go screaming higher and break out. And we maybe see 350, 370 on the upside on the 10-year yield. And to me, this is such an important moment for the yield. We finished this big rally that lasted from August of 2017 all the way through into the second quarter of this year. And since then, the yields have been consolidating in this kind of 310 to 280 area, something you've talked about week after week. And really, is this a topping formation or is this a consolidation before we have a continuation of this trend higher? That is so important to watch, because if we get a breakout of this consolidation to the upside, all the measure moves are suggesting 350, 370. And boy, the markets, I don't think, are going to like that. That's sort of the homework for our listeners to watch over the next month while we're off the air.
Yeah, it definitely is. And boy, this chart pattern leaves so much room for any possibility, because you can easily look at this and say, look, it's a pretty consistent pattern of higher highs and higher lows. The uptrend is still intact. It's still moving higher. You kind of squint your eyes and look at it a little bit differently. Hey, baby, that is a head and shoulders, right shoulder that's forming, and it's about to move down, and then we're going to get, you know, oh boy. And then you look at it again and you say, wait a minute. No, it really looks like it is the lower low didn't last. We see that big doji candle there, and then we see that we move to a higher low, and then we're starting to move in the direction of higher. No, wait a minute. I see a diamond top in this pattern. Really, I do. You know what? It can go any place from here. There is no conclusive pattern that I see in this chart that really is definitely anything. Could be the beginning of a head and shoulders, could be a continuing trend higher. And this is the thing to watch, is what happens with treasury yields, what happens with the dollar. And I believe that those are more important considerably than the equity markets themselves. I don't really care whether the S&P moves up or down next week. That doesn't tell me anything about what's happening in the big picture. Whether the dollar breaks 95 and whether or not the 10-year breaks 3%, now those are big important macro signals, and we're right on the verge of breaking both of them.
I couldn't agree more. And this is so important of determining whether this proves to be a topping formation or whether it's a breakout. It's just so important to be able to see what happens. And I'm going to be watching while on vacation, but we'll obviously give everyone an update when we're back on the show at the end of August. Now, I wanted to move on to the third chart, which is on page 4, which is showing a weekly chart of the S&P 500. I thought this was important to put on because we've been showing 4-hour charts. We've been talking about little zigzags and where the market's going on the short term. And, you know, after having both Jesse and David Rosenberg on the show now, and a lot of them are very much of the bias that we're seeing big topping formation. And when you go to David Rosenberg's view, what you can see here is that there was this parabolic blow off in January. Before that, the VIX driven vol crash that occurred in February. And since then, we saw a low in the second quarter, and we've seen that summer rally ensue, very similar to what we've been sharing with our listeners over the last 3-4 months. But you can see we're heading right up to those highs. And this is where that whole narrative you've been talking about, is this going to be a Jeremy Grantham scenario where we break to a fresh new high and then rip to 3,200 on the upside? Or does this in hindsight prove to just being one big topping formation, and 2018 is just one extended top that is 6 to 8, 9 months, maybe even the whole year, and then we see the whole market roll over from these levels? It's going to be so interesting to see how this plays out. But really, those highs are so important. What's your thinking on that?
Well, you said it right at the end there. The highs are so important because David Rosenberg is obviously just absolutely brilliant, very, very accomplished guy, and his views mean a lot to me. Nobody's right 100% of the time, and the way you would know when David Rosenberg is wrong is when we break to new all-time highs, because he was very clear. He said, look, and I think Jesse said the same thing today in this interview, is you want to know when do we get to the acceleration to the upside and the blow-off top that puts in the top. That's what happened in January. Okay, well, if that's your view, and I think there's a lot of good reasons to have that view, then we are about to have our failed rally, and it's all downhill from here. But boy, if we break above that level and we see daily, or more importantly, weekly closes above the previous level, that is an indication that the view that David and Jesse have expressed, as it was very well informed, turned out to be wrong, and it's time to rethink the whole situation. We're not there yet, but boy, it's I think by the time we're back on August 30th, we're going to have some interesting conversations about how this actually played out.
Now, so let's move on to the fourth chart, which is on page 5 of the chart book, and that's just going back to the same 4-hour chart that we've been sharing over and over again for the last 3-4 months, doing the play-by-play on each leg of this rally that we've been seeing up toward the previous highs. And we certainly got the throwback off of the target zone, the first kind of rejection like we were showing last week as a potential overhead resistance. But really, today's reversal back up is really teasing like this is a flagging formation and about to once again do another leg higher. And will we get it? I mean, what to me, it's a lot about the price action. Right now, technically, with a breakout like we saw today, if the bulls and the buy on dip traders are still in control, there should only be upwards momentum from here. If we find that after a day or two, it fails to make a higher high from last week's high and rejects there and rolls over, then those are going to be important price action clues, because it means that now there's very ample amount of supply and distribution into overhead resistance. And that's where things will get really messy, because, like, for instance, we had this big report on Bloomberg came out with saying that Morgan Stanley is saying that we're just on the verge of another market correction, almost as big or the most significant one since February. Very rarely do you see a story like that really come to fruition perfectly. Often market tops are far messier. They fake out. They have a lot of times where they draw shorts to pile in very quick, and then they get stopped out with a quick rip to the upside. I honestly think that this time around, it's going to be a very messy exercise along the tops. And I think there's going to be a lot of fake outs. Generally, I think that overhead resistance will prevail, but I don't think it's going to be very easy shorting it here. But it'll be very interesting how this plays out here throughout the month of August. Certainly, I'll be looking forward to when we get back here on August 30th to give everyone an update as how the summer's been playing out.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, as so many people have said in the past, trying to call market tops and bottoms is almost impossible. And most accomplished short sellers would tell you, you're not trying to sell the top. There is no magic moment to know when that is. The magic moment is when you're sure that a downtrend is in play and you're early in a new trend. And, you know, we don't have that yet. So it's not time to short this market. It's probably time to be thinking about either getting out or hedging your downside and protecting your gains that exist here. But it certainly, in my opinion, is not time to short it yet. I think that it's going to be an interesting picture when we get back on August 30th. And by Labor Day, it should be really interesting.
All right, Eric. Now, I wanted to move on because we wanted to talk a little bit about Macro Voices Live and what me and you were going to present during this session. Why don't we start off with you? What's your game plan? What are you planning on doing your presentation on during the Macro Voices Live?
Well, I wanted to do something that's completely new content that I haven't done on the show before. So my topic is called Beyond Crypto, the Future of Digital Currencies. And I'm invoking my background in distributed software technology and looking not at cryptocurrency. I mean, I do look at that in the presentation in terms of putting what is going on in the cryptocurrency space in perspective. But I'm really looking ahead toward what I think is coming next after cryptocurrency. And there's a lot of reasons that I think government-issued digital currency built on, and I'll talk about this at the event next week, built on a different technology called a permissioned ledger is really where we're headed. And I think eventually we really get to a question of what does it take in order to dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency. I think there's a very good chance a digital currency will take that title away from the dollar, but it's not going to look anything remotely close to the current generation of cryptocurrencies. So we're going to try to distinguish digital currency technology in the longer term from the current phenomenon of cryptocurrencies and look at where the trend may be headed. How about you, Patrick? What are you going to cover?
Well, Eric, how could I do a presentation without including options in it? So I had to really choose something that inspired me to bridge the way we kind of look at things macro, but also how we can use options as strategic tools to create better asymmetry in trading opportunities. But I was really inspired back in February when we had Rick Rule on the show, and I encourage many of our newer listeners to go back to the February 22nd podcast, because Rick Rule's interview on natural resource investing was just phenomenal. During that session, he started off saying that natural resource investing is different than most mainstream forms of investing. It's unusually capital intensive and unusually cyclical. And that kind of inspired me when he said that. And I started doing back testing and I started measuring how volatile the actual cycles in resource companies have been. And it's extraordinary. I'm going to be sharing all the charts on it, but the cycles have just been so pronounced and so deep in both down and up. And it really makes options trading a really interesting tool to use in those types of cycles, particularly that arguably options on resource companies are actually, in to one degree or another, mispriced. Anyways, lots of fun stuff I'm going to be talking about during that session, and I look forward to it.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it too, and particularly to meeting a lot of our listeners face to face. You know, folks, we produce this podcast with a lot of passion. We really hope that we're doing a good job. Frankly, we don't even know who's listening to it. We have barely had the opportunity to meet people face to face in person who are listeners to the program. So having 150 of them all in one place at one time is going to be a real treat for me. And what I'm particularly excited about, Patrick, is the way that you, and I want to credit you for being the one who saw this, you designed this to intentionally choose a small venue, knowing it was going to sell out, so we could do a small event that was cozy enough that there was a small enough number of people that everybody gets a chance to meet everybody and hang out with the speakers. We have a very significant part of this is going to be our town meeting forum, where we have all six of the speakers on stage, but the audience actually directs the conversation by asking questions, and we have kind of a town meeting discussion. So I'm looking forward to that, and I'm particularly looking forward afterwards to our meet and greet at the venue and then the dinner and after party later, because I really want to talk to more Macro Voices listeners and find out what it is that you like and don't like about the show, how we can make it better, and what other kinds of events we should consider bringing you in the future. So I'm really excited. Those of you who are attending, I look forward to meeting you next week. And on that note, I'll ask the rest of you, we still need your help promoting Macro Voices, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you of registration is that you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email, which never contains any marketing or advertising. It's just a list of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet, including supporting materials such as the chart books that go with our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
All right, well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Jesse. There's also the link to the chart book for Jesse's interview and the charts that you and I discussed during the post game. There's also a number of links to the blog posts and articles that Jesse has written that you referenced throughout the entire presentation. I also attached a quarterly briefing by Daniel Want from Prerequisite Capital. I thought it was a really interesting read, and I encourage all of our listeners to actually have a look at it. Nonetheless, you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, please send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MBRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.